This is Ian Pickus, and we are back in the Congressional Corner today with an old pal, Tim Versalotti, professor of political science at Western New England University. Tim, how are you?
I'm doing well, and it's great to be here, Ian. It's such a privilege to get to talk to you about politics and policy.
And there is certainly a lot of it to talk about, that's for sure. I had a question for you. You know, we so often talk about what elected officials' polling looks like. And I've noticed from the left some glee over poor polling by President Donald Trump of late. But does that matter when a president is already in their second term?
It's a really good question. It can, in a generic presidency, if your polling goes too far south, the party and your party members in Congress may decide they're going to become a bit more independent because they see the potential for an unpopular president to drag down the party and make it difficult for people who will face the voters again someday. But this particular president commands a level of loyalty and fear that is very unusual, obviously. We had Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska openly acknowledging that she is afraid to disagree with the Trump administration. That should be a marker to everyone that this is not a situation where poll numbers are going to allow members of Congress to sort of leave the reservation. There's a lot more holding them in line. Having said that, there may be a point where things get so, the situation gets so dire that members of Congress decide, well, they have to go for broke. The economy really took a hit when the tariffs were announced and before the 90-day moratorium. I can't help but think even just a handful of members of Congress were looking at this as a set of kitchen table issues for constituents who were seeing their retirement savings or their children's college savings drying up and began to wonder whether they could still support the administration. So there are limits in theory. We haven't seen them yet with this administration, though.
Yeah, and I wanted to follow up on that because, you know, traditionally Congress, even if they're in the, you know, if the leadership are in the same party as the president, has wanted to stake out a level of independence from the executive branch. And critics of this Congress say that's not happening. Do you agree?
I would agree. There is a tradition on both sides, looking back over time, where the leadership of the president's party in certain situations will go to the White House and essentially give a reality check and say, this is what we can do for you. This is no longer feasible. I think back to President George W. Bush's second term. Shortly after the start of the term, he was talking about, he was floating a trial balloon about allowing Americans to invest some of their Social Security savings in Wall Street, essentially to partially privatize the system. And the Democrats built opposition to it by calling it gambling with people's life savings, a reckless idea. And eventually, the leadership in Congress had to communicate to the president, this isn't going anywhere, and you need to focus your energies elsewhere. That sort of dynamic simply does not exist right now.
Now, let's talk about some of the members from your neck of the woods, and they are both regular guests on this show, too. Congressman Richard Neal and Congressman Jim McGovern, they're both longtime members of the House. McGovern goes back to the 90s and Neal the 80s, and they had worked their way up through the majority when Democrats were in charge to some really plum committee assignments. But how are they approaching their job now that Republicans are back in charge and Democrats do not have a lot of levers?
Yeah, so Congressman Neal is ranking member of the House Ways and Means Committee. Congressman McGovern is ranking member of the Rules Committee. But the reality is this: in the chamber, the Republicans have 220 seats, the Democrats 213, with two vacancies due to members who had passed away. So they're really, McGovern and Neal are really limited in what they can do. So they have resorted to the bully pulpit. And we saw in the most recent recess, they were both in their districts, speaking out wherever they could in front of friendly audiences to push back on some of the administration's priorities. For example, Congressman Neal went to an assisted living facility in Wilbraham to talk about the House budget resolution, where they're trying to find $1.5 trillion in cuts to help perpetuate tax cuts. And it's very difficult to imagine that occurring without cuts to entitlements, specifically Medicaid, which it not only ensures poor and working class families, it also pays for nursing home care and in-home care for people who are trying to age in place at home. Neal knew exactly who he was talking to, knew exactly how he could get a headline out of it, and he did. And that he went to other stops to talk about infrastructure spending that was being pulled back again, just to highlight this, to get some news coverage. And we're seeing the same thing with Jim McGovern. Congressman McGovern was at a town hall in Waitley recently, where he talked about the importance of people showing up at rallies and protests. People who live in Massachusetts might wonder, well, why? Because public opinion being such that it is here, it's not like you need to change a lot of minds. But McGovern made clear it's being in the streets, marching, carrying signs that the voters can convey to the administration their dissatisfaction with what's going on. McGovern even said at this town hall, it's time to think out of the box. It's even time to think about things like a general strike, which is up to now, it's been a small idea on really the far left of the political spectrum, trying to organize Americans to sign on to stage a general strike, which is a technique used much more often in Europe because the membership in labor unions as a proportion of the workforce is much higher in Europe. And it was really interesting to see a senior member of Congress embrace an idea like a general strike that up to now has really not gotten endorsement from many mainstream politicians. So Neal and McGovern are using their platforms to the best that they can because they just don't have a lot of power within the legislative process right now.
Obviously, President Trump made inroads in November, all over the U.S., including in blue states. Has the terrain shifted at all in Massachusetts?
It's hard to tell, to be honest. I haven't seen a lot of recent polling in Massachusetts. What we know is nationally, CNN just had a piece on do Trump voters regret their vote? Because there is anecdotal evidence when news media convene focus groups or they return to places where they had interviewed people in swing states in the fall. But the data, at least nationally, aren't showing buyer's remorse just yet. Now, it could be that Trump voters are proud. People don't like to say they've changed their minds. It makes them seem inconsistent or unserious. We're not seeing that. What we are seeing are some changes to the president's job approval, which is a whole other subject to discuss. We're just not seeing a lot of evidence of buyer's remorse just yet.
Let's talk now about the two U.S. senators in Massachusetts and how they are approaching this moment. We should start with Senator Elizabeth Warren, who was a candidate for president not so long ago. Now she finds herself in the minority in the Senate. How is she approaching her job of late in the second Trump term?
Elizabeth Warren is using her oversight authority wherever she can to try and hold the administration accountable. She is particularly interested, as you can imagine, in the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Way back when, in the first Barack Obama term, Elizabeth Warren helped to design that agency as a way to hold banks and other financial institutions accountable for their treatment of consumers. And since the Bureau has been established, it has clawed back hundreds of millions of dollars for consumers for various charges, overdraft fees, any number of things. Under the current administration, that Bureau has been pretty much decimated at this point. And Elizabeth Warren said, she was quoted in a Bloomberg piece recently, "The Wall Street cops are gone." So wherever she can, in hearings or in public speeches, she is speaking out about consumer issues and pushing back. In terms of the Senate, it's difficult to get a whole lot done. There is still the filibuster for some things. So Democrats there have marginally more power than they do in the House. They can also put holds on presidential nominees. But for Elizabeth Warren, she is engaging in oversight. The other area where she has demanded information is in the treatment of immigrants who have been taken into custody by ICE. And she has taken a particular interest in the case of Rumeysa Öztürk, the Tufts University graduate student from Turkey, who was taken into custody by ICE. You couldn't call it an arrest. She was apprehended, if you will, was captured.
Yeah, startling video. No question.
It's gone viral. The individuals taking her into custody were wearing masks. She was shouting and screaming. And I have shown it to my students as a point of information and as an educational opportunity. And we have discussed this issue in there. And the visuals bring it home in a way that my description of it here really doesn't do it justice. But Elizabeth Warren, along with Ed Markey and Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, have demanded from the State Department an update on this case, the rationale for taking her into custody. This is something that they want from the State Department. Now, whether they'll get it or not is anybody's guess. But the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, obviously a former senator, knows well some of the arcane procedural tools that even senators in the minority have to gum up the works in the Senate. So it remains to be seen whether this is going to be an effective request. Elizabeth Warren also sounded the alarm when President Trump implied recently that he would like to fire the chair of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell. Now, presidents don't have the power to fire the chair of the Fed, technically. Powell's term ends next year. And President Trump's remarks in this area, he's frustrated with Powell because he would like to see interest rate cuts. Powell and the Fed have been hesitant to do that because they don't want to fuel inflation. When the president made these remarks, it moved the markets, as a presidential comments can do on a regular basis. And Elizabeth Warren got on the air and said this would crash the markets if the president tried to fire the chair of the Federal Reserve. So again, her legislative oversight powers and her bully pulpit powers are the ways that Elizabeth Warren is trying to push back. Ed Markey has been doing the same. He, along with Senator Warren, have asked for additional information about cuts to LIHEAP, the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program, which is critical, of course, in New England, and it helps poor and working class families to pay their heating bills. And we've seen significant increases in fuel bills this past winter. They have asked the Department of Health and Human Services There have been cuts to the LIHEAP staff. How are you going to deliver these essential services to our constituents? Again, oversight. That's one of the key tools of a senator, and both Warren and Markey are trying to use that.
Now, Markey is heading into a re-election bid, and, you know, he's up there in age, although he easily turned away a challenge from a Kennedy the last time he was on the ballot. How does he look to you right now?
Yeah, that's interesting. He'll be 80 when he stands for re-election in 2026. And when he announced his re-election plans in the fall, a reporter asked him about that, and he said, ideas don't have age. So he argues that his policy ideas, his championing of the Green New Deal with AOC, show that it's not your temporal age that determines whether you are fit to serve. It's the innovations, it's the policy ideas that you're putting forward to the voters. There hasn't been an obvious opponent for Markey in the Democratic primary like there was when he ran in 2020. Right now, the prospective candidates, and it's mostly members of the House delegation who would like to move up, like Jake Auchincloss or Ayanna Pressley, have not indicated that they would be willing to take on Markey because he's a pro, he's a seasoned veteran, and he can raise considerable sums of money. The open question is, will he have young people on social media deploying TikTok and Instagram in particular on his behalf? The Markeyverse, which was such an extraordinary campaign dynamic in 2020. Young people are not enamored of the Democratic Party right now. They're sort of disillusioned in part because of Israel and Gaza. Young voters pressured Markey to support a ceasefire, which he eventually did. So whether that he can conjure up that same magic next year, that's something we'll have to wait and see about.
And, you know, I think it is fair to say, and it might be apples and oranges, but voters in the last presidential race, you know, they looked at Joe Biden's performance, not his ideas, you know, and there was an age attached to that. And that really changed the trajectory of that race. So, I mean, I would imagine that Markey's public persona has a long way to go to convincing people he's still up for it.
Oh, he ought to be taking his vitamins and getting in.
Well,
his
we
workouts.
All ought to be, that's for sure.
That's right. He wears running shoes. He's got to keep those on and put them to use just to convey an air of vigor as he gets ready to run.
So just real quick, you know, you were talking about the filibuster. You don't hear a lot from Democrats about the need to get rid of it right now, do you?
No, you don't. And let's be honest, this is something both parties think about. And that's why President Biden was very cautious. Biden being an absolute creature of the Senate, that's where he spent the vast majority of his years of public service. And he knew the wheel of fortune. You're in the majority today, but you might very well be in the minority tomorrow. Don't be so eager to get rid of the filibuster. And we hear much less about filibuster reform at the moment from the Democrats.
Tim, the Attorney General of Massachusetts, was actually on your campus the other day. I was wondering, how is Andrea Joy Campbell approaching this second Trump term from the perspective of a blue state AG?
Well, was it really exciting to have the Attorney General at the Western New England School of Law? It was terrific to have her on our campus and allow our students to have a chance to interact with her as well. So Andrea Campbell is building a profile in her first term, very similar to what put Maura Healey on the political map as Attorney General during President Trump's first term. Attorney General Campbell has filed 12 lawsuits against the Trump administration. The lawsuits include litigation concerning the executive order to essentially decommission the U.S. Department of Education, the dismissal of probationary federal employees, and election reform that Republicans have argued are necessary to secure the vote, but opponents would argue it's really a way to make voting much more difficult for people. Now, she hasn't been doing this single-handedly. In almost every case, she has been part of a group of attorneys general that are challenging the Trump administration on these issues. But as such, it's been keeping her office fairly busy. And there was a piece recently that indicated she's asking for a bump up in her budget for the fiscal year starting July 1. She has an 82, she's asking for $82.7 million, up $5 million from her current budget because of the demands and the work associated with carrying out these efforts to challenge the Trump administration.
Now, you mentioned Maura Healey, who was the AG before. Governors need different things from the White House than AGs do. So how is the Democratic governor approaching this moment?
Her approach has changed, to be honest. At the start of the Trump administration, so we're within the 100 days, and it seems more like a because so much has happened. But early on, Governor Healey took a conciliatory approach because governors need federal assistance and they need a good working relationship with the president, no matter which party the president is from. And so that was her approach early on, a constructive approach. More recently, though, she has taken a more defensive stance because of the budget changes that have really taken a toll or have the potential to take a toll on core Massachusetts economic powerhouses. So healthcare in particular, the cuts to the National Institutes of Health includes a significant sum of money for hospitals in Massachusetts. Also, the clampdown on universities, again, one of the major employers in various parts of the state, and not the least of which, of course, is the administration's demand letter, which they have since, what's the best way to put it, presented some mixed signals on that Harvard dismantle its DEI programs, allow the federal government to have more direct supervision of admissions and hiring. And of course, Harvard has refused. This has put into question about $2.2 billion in federal grants and contracts to Harvard. Maura Healey has been pushing back and saying that this is misguided, not just because this is targeting important institutions in the state that she governs, but that there is the potential for a significant brain drain as a result. As research funding is cut back, as hospitals and universities see their funding diminish, there is a real possibility that researchers will go elsewhere to have their research supported, other countries, not just Western countries, but China, for example. And so what Maura Healey is saying is that this is penny wise and pound foolish. She said on Face the Nation, the CBS weekly Sunday talk show, research labs are shutting down. Scientists or researchers are leaving the United States and going to other countries to do their work. And essentially, Donald Trump is giving away intellectual assets. So she's stepping away from a pure partisan set of criticisms to one of economic and intellectual losses that will affect everyone, no matter who they supported for president or no matter what party they identify with. Will that resonate with the president? I don't know. It might with his advisors. It certainly would with voters. And Mara Healey certainly keeps one eye on the future. She's up for re-election next year. And so she needs to have a public stance where she's defending some of the core employers in Massachusetts, our hospitals and universities.
Well, that brings me to my next question, which is, how is Healey looking in her reelection bid? And I'll say there is so far, you know, a couple of Republicans are in the field or at least kicking the tires on a race. We talked to both of them. There's a state senator from the Worcester area, a former Baker housing secretary. So anybody who Healey should be worried about?
The dynamic, I have to say, and I know this sounds like a dodge.
That's a dodge, not a doge.
Right. This far out, I mean, the dynamics of national and state politics right now are so rapidly changing that the any sort of predictions I make now could be moot next week, let alone next year. But here's how it's shaping up. So Healey has been in full re-election mode. She announced her plans a few months ago. She's out there, she's raising money. Her most recent filing shows she had a pretty good March. She raised $404,000 in March. She's got cash on hand, $2.89 million. For a re-election campaign, and this would be her fourth statewide campaign, so she's got a pretty well-oiled, not just campaign machine, but fundraising machine as well. The two candidates that you made reference to, one was Peter Durant, a state senator from Worcester, who has promised that he would make a final decision shortly, and then Mike Keneally, who was the Housing and Economic Development Secretary in the Baker administration. Keneally announced a couple of weeks ago that he will be seeking the Republican nomination. He's registered his campaign fundraising committee, but it's too early for any reports, so we can't really judge what kind of money he's bringing in just yet. But we will know soon enough because the candidates file monthly reports with the state. Keneally has indicated here's where he thinks Healey could be weak. One is on housing. One of the central issues of the 2022 governor's race was that it's just too expensive to live in Massachusetts. Housing prices are such that their starter homes are just out of reach, and younger families are finding it harder to get on the housing ladder. And that's the fastest way, or the most reliable way, that's probably a better term, for building long-term wealth is buying and paying off a mortgage on a house. And it's just too difficult for a lot of people in Massachusetts right now. Keneally said, including in an interview on WAMC, that the Healey administration is taking a top-down approach to this, and he finds that that is misguided, that you really need to work from the ground up in individual communities to try to identify and support initiatives to create affordable housing. And in his previous role, he was well traveled around the state. He's got connections at the local level. It gives a compelling air to his argument there. He's also criticizing the Healey administration for not anticipating the migrant shelter crisis, that the right to shelter law in Massachusetts has been on the books for many, many years, and that the outgoing Baker administration warned them that this was going to become an even more significant problem and they needed to be ready for it. I haven't heard many specifics on what Mike Keneally would do differently, but he had said, at least in his interview with you all, that it's time to get back to the original motivation for the right to shelter law. which was Massachusetts families who have fallen on hard times, providing an emergency solution for them that's very short term. The Healey administration has been working on that as well in terms of documenting who is getting this aid. Are they Massachusetts families, making sure local constituents are served first? But that's going to be a pressure point, no question about it.
You know, one wonders, and we're a long way away from a debate right now, but whether Healey would point out that a lot of the migrants were sent to Massachusetts from states with Republican leadership, which helped accelerate the crisis that Keneally refers to. And just a plug here for James Palaiologopoulos, our colleague who's actually based on your campus at Western New England University. He did interviews with both Mike Keneally and Senator Durant about their nascent gubernatorial bids. So if you'd like to hear more from the candidates, that's how you can do it.
Oh, absolutely. That's how I prepped. It was really good work. So here's my expectation, at least now, on what Governor Healey will try to do to whomever is her Republican opponent. She's going to try to box them in. She's going to try, this is my suspicion at this point in time, to link them to an what is most likely to be an unpopular Trump administration in 2026 in Massachusetts, to force candidates to distinguish their positions from those of the leader of their party, and in doing so, do one of a couple of things: scare away moderate or independent voters, which are the biggest voting bloc in Massachusetts, and alienate hardcore Trump supporters who might then think, well, depending on the answers that the Republican nominee gives, if that individual does not show signs of being a true believer, that could depress turnout among the base, the Trump base in Massachusetts, which isn't very large, a Republican candidate's going to need some of that base and a lot of the independent vote in order to win. That's been the recipe in the past. Charlie Baker made clear he was no fan of Donald Trump, and he managed a very easy re-election win in the middle of Donald Trump's first term. But whomever gets the Republican nomination has got to thread that needle and say and point out that they are independent of the president, but do so in a way that doesn't alienate hardcore Republicans whom they might need to put together a winning coalition.
Well, there's a lot of road between now and then, but we'll be sure to ask you about all of these developments in our next round with Tim Versalotti, professor of political science at Western New England University. Tim, we're so grateful for all of your time and insights as always. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. I enjoyed it. Thank you, Ian.